Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Today we'll be listening to the first half of an interview with Jerome C. Glenn, the director of the Millennium Project at the American Council of the United Nations University. Speaking today with Jerome Clayton Glenn. Jerry Glenn has 35 years of experience in futures research and development consulting. He's the executive director of the American Council for the United Nations University, co-founds and directs the Millennium Project, a global participatory think tank that consults with governments and corporations and NGOs about the state of the future, produces the state of the future reports. And recently I read a book of his that was called Future Mind, Merging the Mystical and the Technological in the 21st Century, which apparently he wrote in the late 1970s. And it anticipates so many of the themes that are now being explored in books like More Than Human and Citizen Cyborg. So he really has earned his stripes as a futurist by being able to look that far ahead. And his current work looks as far ahead as the year 3000. So welcome, Jerry Glenn.
Thank you.
I'm really delighted that we finally touched base. I've been hearing about your work for quite a long time. In fact, I think I got a copy of the Future Ethical Issues survey that you sent around recently. You just tell us briefly about that project.
Well, the idea is to try to forecast future ethical issues and what people think about them so that we can maybe be more intelligent when they hit. If we had taken seriously the notion of the information age 30, 40 years ago, we might not have been so surprised by the issues of privacy and the ethical issues involved in it. We might have, you know, come up with a better solution. Had we taken seriously the idea of stem cells 25, 30 years ago, along with cloning and other sorts of same-sex marriages and international interventions and things, if we know that certain things will be coming up, it's reasonable to assume certain things will be coming up. So they're not issues right now, but they eventually will be. Like, do we have a right to clone ourselves? Yes or no? Right now, I don't have a little Heath kit in my pocket to clone myself, but in a future, someone might. Should people be allowed to do that? So part of the job of a futurist is to bring up these things that are not ready for prime time so that people mull through them for years, and then hopefully when they hit as an actual decision, there's a body of informed opinion and thought that can make a better decision than the way we lurch into them today.
It's so important. Recently, my book got panned in the Chronicle of Higher Education, along with some other books about cyborg issues. And the concluding sentence in that review was that we mistook science fiction for science.
And right.
And on the same day that that review came out, there was the announcement that there was a wireless chip for biomedical, for artificial organs that had just been released. And, you know, it just seems like so many of the people who dismiss these issues aren't paying attention to what's happening today, much less what's going to be possible in 10, 15 years.
Oh, I know. I was just in an interview recently with a, to not be named a futurist, when I made a comment about our ability to think and reason and brain cognition and all that sort of stuff will be surprising to people coming up in the future. He said, well, the IQ and brain can't change. I said, yes, it can. Have you read anything about cognitive science in the last 10 years? No. Okay, well, then do so.
Exactly.
You know, read up on it.
Yeah. Tell us about the American Council for the United Nations University. I think, you know, Americans are woefully ignorant of the UN itself and of these para-UN institutions.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, before I do that, I would like to speak directly to your audience on one point, is that the United States is far too powerful to be so ignorant of the world.
Hallelujah.
We're very much like a giant dinosaur with a pea brain. Not that we have a pea brain, but we act as if we do. We are far, far too powerful to be so stupid in the world. We've got to get over that. Now, back to your question. The American Council for the UNU was established by the UNU. The UNU is the United Nations University. United Nations University is a principal academic organ of the UN. So it's like UNDP, United Nations Development Program, or like UNICEF, except it does graduate research among universities around the world, things like what did the world eat today, what is the nutritional content of that food today, and that is then given to the Food and Agricultural Organization, to USAID, to the World Health Organization, who then say, well, this is what people ought to eat, and that's the gap, and therefore they create programs to fill that gap. The UN University does the basic research that the rest of the UN systems in other countries feed off of. Now, the American Council for the UN University was set up by them, headquartered, by the way, in Tokyo. It's the only part of the UN headquartered anywhere in Asia. There are Asian regional bodies of the UN, but as far as an international body of the UN, UN University is the only one in all of Asia. Anyway, they're in the headquartered in Tokyo. They set up, the UN University set up in the United States, the American Council for UNU, to be a liaison between the United States, which then, and still to some degree, still is the largest graduate research system in the world, and to help do a little fundraising, just like the U.S. Committee for UNICEF does in the United States. So it's like a liaison, non-governmental organization.
Now, the project that you have really pioneered here is the Millennium Project. Tell us about that and what its relationship is to the ACUNU.
Okay. The relationship to the ACUNU simply is that I'm the executive director of it, and I'm a futurist, so I just did it here. It's just, you know, if I was at the University of Denver, it would have been the University of Denver. The Millennium Project started with a memo by another futurist named Ted Gordon, or Theodore J. Gordon. Ted Gordon gave you the third stage of the Apollo rocket. He was part of the original Delphi team at the RAND Corporation. He invented cross-impact analysis, trend impact analysis, and probably is more futurist method stuff than any other futurist alive today. Anyway, he figured in the mid-'80s that when the year 2000 would come up, microphones would be crammed down our throats, like this radio show and so forth, and say, okay, tell me everything about the future. And it would be a great teaching moment to have humans think about the future at the year 2000. And we futurists ought to anticipate that and put together some mega study. His group, called the Futures Group, which is the first for-profit think tank, knew that it couldn't do it because the world wouldn't believe some for-profit think tank doing a study of the future, so they could contribute to it, but they couldn't do the whole thing. Ought to have something, a UN relationship. And since I was the UNU relationship and I could spell the word future, they gave me the memo and said, can you do something with this? And I said, sure, with one change. We don't need another mega study. That's been the whole history of futures research. It's a series of fanfares, of great studies, a Club of Rome study, the Inter-Future study, all these sort of things. And they help along the way. But what we need is some sort of a cumulative system to generate some real wisdom about the future. We have in chemistry the periodic table where we can keep track of our knowledge as we progress along, chemical abstracts and so forth. We have ways of knowing we're doing better in certain fields. We didn't have it in future studies. So along, you know, let's say back in 1985, somebody says, are we doing better or worse about thinking about the future? In 1995, better or worse, thinking about the future. They had no systematic way for the human-informed intelligentsia to think together about the future. That's not the UN, because that's a political structure.
That's really interesting, because when I look back at Future Shock recently, you know, his Toffler's whole idea in Future Shock was that we needed to build in future studies into democracy to have an anticipatory function.
Correct.
And so you had these various panels, as you mentioned, which tried to do that, but just as one-offs. And then you had the future study field, which had all these you know, self-interested futures consultants doing their various things, but it didn't have any cumulative consensus development. And what you're trying to do is try to bring that all together.
Attempting.
Yeah.
And that's why we use the State of the Future as an excuse to do that. I mean, it looks like a book and all that sort of stuff, but it's basically it's a management tool. It sort of says, here's where we are so far. And every year we update and improve that, hopefully.
So you've published, what, five of these now? Five?
The one I'm working on today will be the ninth.
Ah, and so the 2005 State of the Futures Report, which will be out shortly.
In a month or two, I hope, yes.
What are some of the themes in the one that's coming out?
Well, one is 15 global challenges that face humanity, and we update and improve, hopefully, the data about that, the situation, as well as some of the strategies and ideas. And another is what we call a State of the Future Index. It's an index of the next 10 years. It takes the various measures of the 15 global challenges and puts them together in a way I can explain later on if you want to end up with a graph that says here's the next 10 years, here's the last 20 years, and here's the next 10 years of the whole game together. People have rated the various indices and the weights and so forth. So it's an integrated thing. Now, obviously, you can't reduce the future to a single number 10 years out.
Are we getting more optimistic or more pessimistic?
The index is improving over the next 10 years, but not as rapidly as the previous 10 years.
So we're slowing down.
Yeah, but that doesn't. But it's sensitive to several indicators that move around a lot. One is terrorism. Had 9/11 not occurred, and or had we figured out how to avoid the second Iraq War, those numbers would be radically different today. Or, for example, if Mr. Kerry had been elected instead of Mr. Bush, we might not have gone to Iraq, and we might have had a different posture in the world. That also could have affected it. And that's just one. The other is that Russia became much more constrictive in its press relations in the last year or two. And that restriction influences the overall index of Freedom House on press freedom. And that's an important part of the whole picture as well. So all of these variables in there, they're in a cauldron. They're moving around. But in general, we are getting a little better. The aid stuff hasn't been doing too well. And that's a big, heavy variable in there, too. But in general, we're doing a little better than we thought we would. We mean the collective press and indicator of stuff. For example, the environmental global warming picture has gotten worse than previously forecasted from data. The AIDS has gotten not as bad as previously forecasted from DSA data. But the press freedoms, as I mentioned, went down and didn't go up as much as people thought. Terrorism got a lot worse than people thought. So there's something when we do a review in the State of the Future this year on how the State of the Future doing and changing over the past, which is nice to learn from feedback.
You know, I've been looking recently at the UN population estimates and reports and comparing them to the Social Security Department reports here in the States about longevity, because from a transhumanist point of view, our longevity estimates in these, you know, what the year 2080 is going to look like are just wildly crazy.
Of course.
Where they say we're only going to have a lifespan of 85 or whatever.
Of course. And
if those are wrong, then it changes a lot of the other calculations about what we need to do for the future.
Right.
From your future's point of view, obviously you're not a Club of Rome. These aren't kind of... everything's going to go to hell in a handbasket and there's going to be an apocalypse. But on the other hand, the attitudes towards future scenario planning has changed. So could you talk a little bit about that? You're not trying to make predictions here, mm-hmm. but you're trying to extrapolate a little bit, but also lay out scenarios, as I understand it.
Right. The purpose of futures research is to make it smarter, i.e. guess better. It doesn't mean you know what's going to happen, but guess better because you looked at a range of possibilities. I don't know if it was Einstein or somebody that says that, you know, you climb up the top of a hill and you can predict when the train's going to come to the station better than somebody that stays down at the bottom of the hill. So futurists try to get, in a sense, an extra time-dimensional view, try to use a variety of different methods. When people say they're blind, they guessed wrong because they blindsided, well, then look in your blind side more often. But much of the movement of change since, say, the 60s has been move away from the idea of saying by 2025 you'll have 25 robots picking your nose, from that kind of a forecast to say, what do we want a robot to do? So we're more into shaping the future and informing the decision makers and educators about the options than in forecasting a particular capability at a certain time. Although
and
we
getting
do that
people
a little bit as input.
And getting people talking about what we might do with robots of certain kinds, because it's possible that we might have them. A lot of these.
It was about 400,000 in operation in Japan right now.
Right. Marshall Brain's been doing some wonderful work. I don't know if you've seen his website. He's got a kind of robot watch site where he reports about all the different fields that are being robotized. Mm. By the way, for the listeners, the site acunu.org has a lot of the reports and kind of frameworks that you're using. It's a wonderful site. Other things can be ordered from there. Let's talk about some of the themes that, by the way, I'm speaking with Jerry Glenn. He's a futurist of 35 years, development consultant. He's had a computer company. He's co-founded the Millennium Project now, which, as we're talking about, is a systematic effort to explore the state of the future and publish works about that. And he's a published author of many, many tomes. And one of the themes here on Change Surfer Radio is global governance, because I've long been a world futurist and pin a lot of my hopes on a better future on the evolution of collective security and redistributive mechanisms between the developing and developed world. And I have been depressed the last couple of weeks because of the collapse of the European Union effort with the French and Dutch vote, which I saw as kind of a test run for the idea of global federalism. And also, of course, the UN project is not doing as well as it could, even though there are signs of hope here and there. So from your perspective as someone, a part of the UN world, and also living in George Bush's America, which is intensely suspicious and hostile towards any kind of global federalism, where do you think this project of global governance is going?
Well, it's to be remembered that one of the better forecasting tools in politics is a pendulum. You know, it goes left wing for a while, it goes right wing for a while, it goes left wing for a while. So the current posture of the White House will change. We cannot live in a world that does not have trans-border checking of food quality to prevent diseases. So we need the FAO. We can't live in a... We wouldn't be able to get in airplanes today if it wasn't for the World Health Organization stopping SARS. Remember, Canada was closed down for a little while. We have to have global governance systems with or without the United States. I mean, the United States is under 5% of the world. You know, quote, deal with it, as they say. England still thinks it's ruling the world, but it's not. We're going to have to grow up, Americans. We are very adolescent. We're very young in the world game. We've got tremendous power. I mean, if you think of the idea of a giant, strong teenage athlete, doesn't mean he knows more than the old professor. We have much to learn about collaborating with other people, and we're going to have to, or they're going to leave us behind. China, with a low wage and at the same time a high tech, will be able to manufacture just about anything, period, that they want to. I don't know if your listeners know this, but there's more cell phones in use right at this moment in China than anywhere else in the world. They're the number two in internet usage at home right now. South Korea has the highest percent of people with broadband in the world. They're making an agreement to do ubiquitous computing as the norm in South Korea. And we're still debating all kinds of stuff here. Anyway, do I think that global governance is going to come on and evolve? Yes, with or without the United States. Do we got to have it? Of course we do. We have to think of this as a little bit like the autonomic nervous system of a human being. We don't want to keep remembering to beat our heart, because if we did, we would be dead. We want an autonomic nervous system to run the digestive system, to handle reflexes, all that stuff. And we have to do that for global civilization. We have to create an autonomic nervous system, and that's what governance is. It doesn't mean global government. It doesn't mean the whole world is run by a single political entity. That's not going to happen. What history is telling us, that whatever you look at, it gets more complex. So I'm not worried about being, quote, taken over. What I am worried about is the idea of threats coming up into the future from all the way from individuals creating weapons of mass destruction and acting independently of even groups, that if we don't have large-scale global systems of governments to prevent these sort of things, then we may not make it into the future. I'm not a apocalyptic guy, but that's a serious consideration.
I cut my political teeth as a post after I graduated from college. I went to Sri Lanka and arrived just in time for the beginning of the Sinhala-Tamil Civil War.
Oh boy!
And meditating on that experience there, literally, I began to see that we really needed to transcend nationalism. It was already something that I believed in, but saw it quite viscerally. And for many years, I've thought, you know, that we needed to have a campaign of a more vocal campaign to transcend nationalism and create global citizenship. But it really seems like it takes these collective challenges like 9/11s to get people to think in a trans-border way about their common dilemmas.
Yeah.
Well, so the EU thing, you think that this is just a temporary setback?
Yes, I do. After all, if you go back just a few years, the idea of an integrated currency was scoffed and laughed at regularly. People said it's never happened. People will never go to it. Forget it, you know. This is, in a sense, one of the first major quote-unquote setbacks in the slow-motion march toward an integrated Europe. Some people argue that it might have been wiser to have had the Constitution before the rapid growth of the EU in the last couple of years. So tactically, that may have been a mistake. It may have been easier to get an agreement on a Constitution with a small number of players than to have a small number of players figure they're going to be overruled by issues from a larger number of people.
Get a spine first and then add muscles instead of the other way around.
That's one thought. But in any case, I mean, nothing's going to change. I mean, Europe is still there. I mean, it's the currency is still there. The rules are still there. The parliament's still, all these things are still there. As I remember correctly, UK has been working quite well without a constitution, isn't that right?
Absolutely.
So they may take years to develop the constitution, get it agreed to, but okay, so what?
I have the same sense of optimism in the end, but I was disappointed in my French and Dutch friends, some of whom on the left, you know, had interesting reasons for opposing it. But.
Well, it was interesting. In the French one, I don't know, you may not want to deal with contemporary politics, but both the conservatives and your left wing, both extreme right and extreme left, were allied.
Right. Well, let me tell you about something else that's going on with me. As involved in the World Transhumanist Association and with this upcoming conference in Caracas, we've had this upsurge of interest in transhumanism in Africa. And I thought you'd be a perfect person to talk to about this because it's been fascinating to me how Africans, we have a chapter now in Kenya, a chapter in Uganda, and a new chapter of Somali refugees in universities in Nairobi who've started the Somali Transhumanist Association. Mm-hmm. So a country without, you know, a very stable government. And,
well, I know. I've been there a couple of times. Somali, by the way, means gypsy.
Does it really?
Yeah. So the idea of talking about the Somali borders is like saying, what's the borders in Europe of the gypsies?
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
So it seems to me like the way that the Africans are appropriating the transhumanist idea is it's kind of like the Enlightenment on steroids. And that bothers some people, but it doesn't bother me because it seems like we do need, in parts of the developing world, a renewed enthusiasm about the project of modernity. And I was wondering what you thought about that.
Well, it's great. I did get an invitation from the Nairobi folks. No, it was the Nigeria folks just to come out there. I couldn't at the time. It may be a phenomenon that a jump from A to B, in a normal, orderly fashion, like the U.S. might think about in thinking about the future, to someone who hasn't done a whole lot of that, going from A to C may not be any more of a cognitive jump than from A to B.
Right, going from having a personal laptop to having one inside your head.
Yeah, no big jump.
Yeah.
Or to take the one that you're seeing right now in Africa, from having no communications equipment at all, to having a electronic camera, internet, cell phone in your hand. So that jump to go from just a regular crank-up telephone in the general store to that jump looks to us who have gone through the middle steps in the middle, say, like, that's a lot of jumps you're jumping over. To them, it's just the next thing, that's all.
There's a lot of talk about leapfrogging in the development world. Is this a concept that you think is generally applicable? I mean, it's one place
sure.
where it applies is this communication
sure,
technology.
The United States. I mean, England did 200 years of Industrial Revolution, and we did 100. I mean, so, we learn from their mistakes. China's learning from ours.
The other problem, though, is that in a lot of these developing countries, there's going to be such a weak infrastructure for the distribution and assuring the safe use of these technologies. That seems to be the major challenge I would see.
Safe use meaning?
Well, for instance, genetic engineering, nanotechnology, you know, the potentials for accidental use, you know, release or weapons of mass destruction, you know, harmful uses, where you have weaker regulatory mechanisms. And
right. Yeah, that's why one of the things we've got in one of the science and technology scenarios is the development of what's called an International Science and Technology Organization, because it's not reasonable to expect African countries to keep track of the rates of change because you can't even do it in a well-financed United States. I've been in the Academy of Science meetings in the United States several times where someone will say that even in the most narrow specialty of science, I cannot keep track of it, they'll say. So if a hotshot Academy of Science scientist can't keep track of his narrow specialty of the rates of change, how in the world can political folks make judgments about technological applications and rules and laws in their country? I think there's zero chance of doing that. On the other hand, as you started to point out there, the potential hazards coming up are global in scope. And so we still will have to create some sort of, if not, we won't be able to have a regulatory commission for at least not the foreseeable future, but we certainly could get the best and the brightest to do a real human-computer interface laid on top of the world's knowledge of science and technology and have it organized in such a way, or have the interface organized in such a way that a politician in Nigeria or in Washington, when told something on somebody testifying before them about a particular rule of science, technology, or application, could very quickly keyword a voice into a screen in front of them and get there's eight positions on this particular technology. They group this way. These are the thoughts, the assumptions behind each one. And then the politician could ask the person with the screen in front of the eyes going through it, say, well, what about this position, this position, this position? So we could actually get up to snuff much faster than people think will be possible. But I think we'll need an international science technology organization to do that. But that's not an organization like, say, the World Health Organization. We have large staff, because you need a large staff to go around and deal with hemorrhagic disease in Africa and so forth. But an international science and technology organization could be an organization of organizations of information systems and inter-academy panels of academies of science in different parts around the world, such that just like Google can give you very quickly a web page, imagine a next thing where you have a collective intelligence software rather than a browser software, a collective intelligence software that then allows you to very quickly by voice, because it has to be faster in this sort of way, to get to precisely the kinds of information that you want. We're moving into semantic web and all that sort of stuff, so I think it's going to be possible to do that. And I'd like to see the September General Assembly of the United Nations, somebody come up and say, we need some system, some global system, maybe blessed through the UN or how else, that could provide this interface so that intelligent decisions about science and technology can be made not only by governments, by individual players, which can also monitor where the knowledge is. So there are implications for that on security as well.
This has been the first half of an interview with Jerome C. Glenn. He's the executive director of the American Council for the United Nations University, and he directs the Millennium Project. He's the author of many books, futurist consultant of 35 years. Check back next week for the second half of this interview with Jerome Glenn, or listen to it on changesurfer.com. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's J-H-U-G-H-E-S at changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the A Infos Radio Project. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.